Hello and welcome to this, the latest in a series of podcasts from Polity. My name is George Miller, and I'm delighted to say my guest in this programme is cultural sociologist Eva Illouz. Eva Illouz was born in Morocco and educated in France, Israel and the United States. She's taught in France, Germany and the US, including a visiting professorship at Princeton, and is now professor of sociology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Her list of prize-winning publications includes Consuming the Romantic Utopia, Oprah Winfrey and the Glamour of Misery, and Cold Intimacies, The Making of Emotional Capitalism, which is available from Polity. In 2009, the German newspaper Die Zeit included her in a list of the 12 thinkers most likely to shape the thought of tomorrow. And another magazine hailed her as a great public intellectual of the future. When Eva visited London recently, I met up with her to discuss her latest book, Why Love Hurts, called by the Times Higher, bold and thought-provoking. Of her ambitions for the book, she says, "My aim is to do for love what Marx did to commodities, to show that it is shaped and produced by concrete social relations, to show that love circulates in a marketplace of unequal competing actors, and to argue that some people command greater capacity to define the terms in which they are loved than others." Below this top-level ambition, Illouz explores the ways in which we experience love and its pains, how our sense of self is increasingly bound up with, even constituted by it, how the possibility of infinite choice makes choosing and committing more rather than less difficult, and how irony has become a self-protective layer, the mode par excellence of knowingly expressing modern love and insulating oneself from disappointment. Along the way, Illouz uses evidence from great classics of 19th century fiction to help measure the distance we've travelled from pre-modern modes of loving. And equally tellingly, she uses the frank admissions of her contemporary interview subjects to shed light on love as it's experienced today. I began by telling Eva that I had found her comparison of late Victorian courtship manuals and contemporary dating guides instructive, and asked her to say a little about what she had found in them.
Well, if you agree with me that advice books are supposed to give you a sense of orientation, then it is a very good indication of what people think is disorienting and probably also what is actually disorienting. In the 19th century, some of the courtship or many of the courtship manuals I found had to do with providing the right etiquette, the right rules of behavior, whether to carry the umbrella of a woman or not, whether to smoke in her presence or not, or how to invite your suitor in the company of whom, etc. When we look at the guidebooks on dating, for example, that have been written in the last 20 years, we see vastly different set of concerns in which the self is presented as being very fragile and as being in need of being taken care of. And the advice provided is not one that concerns the proper rules of conduct, the right etiquette, but rather it has to do with how to manage a set of anxieties that are attached to the dating and courting process. And these anxieties have to do with the fact that you are now taking a risk in courting someone, and the risk is a risk of being rejected. Of course, there has always been a risk of being rejected when you courted a woman in the past, but that risk was regulated. There were appropriate mode of rejecting, and there was a way in which people did not feel that it was their whole self, their whole identity that was rejected. What emerges from contemporary guidebooks is the fact that people feel that it is their whole self, their identity, that is in fact at stake.
Now, I suppose we tend to think of ourselves in some ways as superior, when it comes to our love lives, as superior to our predecessors, because we have many more freedoms than they did to express ourselves in words or sexually or in our choice of partners. But your book, Why Love Hurts, shows that freedom in and of itself brings its own problems, its own set of problems. And since Freud,
we've tended to see those problems through the lens of psychology. And one of the very important things which your book does is challenge the use of that lens and actually say there are ways in which it is inadequate. And if we look at it sociologically, it opens up a whole different perspective.
Oh, absolutely. But first, let me provide a caveat. I'm not saying that there are no people with a serious psychological problems. And I'm not saying that psychology does not have real effects. It does. That's why we actually want to engage with it. But the main effect of psychology has been to privatize problems. And I say privatize in the same way that we mean privatization in the economic realm. That is, problems that should be thought about collectively are now deemed to be the territory of the single individual. And that's what psychology has done. So many women are taught the secret or not so secret art of trying to catch the heart of a man who will not commit to them. And commitment phobia is in fact has taken the proportions of a moral panic all over the Western world. And commitment phobia is often associated with the pathological psyche of the man. And there is endless talk on how men are actually unable to attach themselves seriously to women, either for biological reasons or for psychological reasons. Well, I hope to have shown in this book that the problem of commitment phobia is a problem that derives from the transformation in the structure of choice, of how choice has changed from the 19th to the 20th century. And when we look at a lot of research in cognitive psychology that has been done on choice, we can see that when people have a lot of choice, in fact, it prevents them from making a decision. So this is really a book that is in close dialogue with many of the research done in decision making, but instead of being psychological, it is sociological, and it shows the impact of having a lot of choice and of changing the agencies or the institutions which are in charge of regulating the choice of a partner.
Ava, maybe I can get you at this stage to say something about your methodology. I mean, it's striking from the book that you adduce a lot of evidence from pre-20th century literature, you know, Jane Austen or Gustave Flaubert or many other writers. And also, when it comes to the present day, you conducted many face-to-face interviews yourself. So maybe you can tell me how you proceeded and what you were looking for in both those sources.
I read these novels, but not as a way to get to the hard, direct evidence. Of course not. But I read literature because literature codifies often implicit assumptions about emotions, about how people talk to themselves, about the kind of stories that sit in people's heads. But mostly I read pre-20th century literature because what you're looking for when you are analyzing something that is very close to you, you're looking for ways to understand what is new about your own world. And quite often it is quite difficult to understand that. And this is what cultural sociologists try to do. They try to find the relevant features of a cultural set they're looking at. So just to give you an example that's not in the book, but that has to do with pain, when we torture someone, well, hopefully we don't anymore, but torture or physical pain, but let's say the torture of a delinquent, of a criminal, we think of it as being the pain of the person that is being tortured. Lynn Hunt, in her great book, Inventing Human Rights, argues that before the notion of human rights, pain was not the pain of the criminal, the private pain of the person who is being tortured, but the pain was viewed as a kind of collective experience, a collective retribution in which the community was involved. So this is the kind of insight you can get at with regard to what is unobvious about your own assumptions today. Again, we would think today that it's very obvious that we think of the pain of someone tortured as being their pain and not ours. So in order just to be made aware of what is so obvious that you don't see anymore, I went back to these texts and I was able indeed to find, for example, this idea that choice, architecture and ecology of choice, that choice was how individuals choose or don't choose or are constrained in their choice of a mate, was Jane Austen was crucial to me.
Maybe I could get you to say a little bit about what you found to be the salient differences between that architecture and ecology of choice in Jane Austen's time and ours.
Well, obviously I go into much more detail in the book, but I'll just give you one example. The woman in Jane Austen's novel is courted by the man in her home. And what takes place is then a natural process in which the suitor is observed and evaluated not only by her, by a whole set of people. And it happens very naturally. It is the group, in fact, and the woman as a member of the group who is making the judgment and the evaluation of the appropriateness of the man's manners. Now, we tend to think of this as a constraint, as something that limited people's capacity to express their feelings independently from the group. But what we're missing out is the fact that when the woman was evaluating a man, she was in a way protected by the group. She did it along with others. And if a man was behaving badly, she was not alone. There was the group who was the moral arbiter of how bad he was behaving. Think about Marianne and Willoughby. When it turns out that Willoughby, who has courted her assiduously, in fact was engaged to someone else, Marianne is devastated, but so is everyone else. And everyone else is also able to proffer a moral judgment of his bad behavior. So that changes entirely the ways in which, first of all, women evaluate men, the behavior of men to women, and the ways in which she judges him in case he defaults on her or he behaves badly. So that's only one example.
And the other form of evidence that you collected was the interviews. You did one-to-one, talking to people about their own experience of love and its pains.
Absolutely. And I interviewed people in different countries, United States, Israel, France, and a bit of Germans as well. And it was quite remarkable, actually, to see the consistency of complaints. They have to do with some similarities across all countries. For example, the fact that women are increasingly more educated and that women have made tremendous gains in terms of their autonomy and sexual freedom. These are the dimensions which make many of these experiences actually more similar than different, although obviously you could find differences.
I mean, socioeconomic differences, class differences?
If I looked at them, no. No, actually, this could be actually a critique that one could level at me. And it is that it is not a book that is concentrating on working class men, for example. I would say it is written, and I say it repeatedly, it is written from the standpoint of middle class heterosexuality, heterosexual and even more heterosexual women. It is a critique of heterosexuality, but not from a lesbian standpoint, which is a very valid critique, but it's not the standpoint I take. The book, therefore, is less relevant for women who have opted not to have children or not to be in a domestic setup. It is mostly directed to the women who are who still want, the women and men who are choosing the heterosexual formula to organize their lives, their private lives and sexual lives.
Now, you came up with what I thought was a very memorable phrase, the penetration of economics into the machine of desire. And I guess that comes really close to the heart of your analysis. So I wondered if you could just expand a little bit on what you meant by that.
Well, economics, of course, is always somewhat a part of all human practices. And in pre-modern Europe, marriage was certainly motivated by economic considerations. So you married to expand your property or for social mobility, and you married within your social class. You also could marry for affective reasons. It was more rare. And you, if you were very, very lucky, you could marry for both reasons. But very obviously, pre-modern people held both models very distinct from each other.
And there's a sense of good enough being good enough for pre-moderns. You find a sufficiently acceptable mate, and that's where you stop selecting.
Absolutely. And because you're not marrying in order to sustain, or with the hope to sustain, a great mad love, as soon as you find someone who is socially compatible and who is good enough in terms of how he looks or general personality traits, you settle down. Which means, interestingly enough, that what we call rational pre-modern way of marrying actually looks to us very irrational, because people would settle down much more quickly and knowing far less about the partner than we do. We are the ones who have become highly rational, far more than our pre-modern predecessors. But just to go back to your first question, I just wanted to say that pre-modern people held these two models, affection and economics, quite separate, and if they mixed or met each other, that was great luck. When capitalism comes around, people are less dependent on inheritance to get married. The choice of a mate is much more left to the discretion of the individuals themselves. And so you have now the possibility for people to choose whoever they want. Sociologists and economists show that despite or along with that autonomy of choice, of emotional choice, people still marry within their class. So that's interesting, because it would then suggest that marriage or choice of a partner is actually still an economic, in the broad sense of the word, an economic operation. In other words, you're not thinking crassly, as we maybe for us pre-modern people did before. This is not an economic transaction, but still we're doing something that makes our love choices somewhat relevant to our economic interest. So what is it? And this is what the book examines, how we do actually mix these two logics, the emotional and the economic ones, is one that the book looks at.
Now, you quote some correspondence between Victorian spouses in the book, and the modern reader, I think, will find it very cold and very distant compared to the way that we are used to sharing our feelings. But the corollary of that is that we seek and hope for a much greater need for validation from our amorous relationships. Can you say a little bit more about that?
That is interesting what you say, because my impression was in a way the opposite one, namely that, I mean, you're right, and there is a paradox here, that namely that the Victorians were on the one hand much more distant from each other than we think of today. And yet the language of passion was much more straightforward. They would look to us like hystericals today in many ways.
I think you're quite right, actually. I think I was thinking about some of the correspondence after marriage, but you're quite right that the correspondence before marriage is of a much higher emotional temperature.
Yes, absolutely. And so that cooling down of passion, and even the word passion is not really used anymore. And in fact, you know, if it is used with an ironic smile. We can't really believe in that stuff anymore. So you are completely right. The movement is like this. Men and women have much clearer roles. And that these roles mean that they belong to different spheres, and that women and men don't make too many, or sometimes not even at all, emotional demands or claims on each other. They live with each other by knowing the rules of appropriate etiquette and behavior. There is a question of appropriate etiquette and behavior, whereas our notion of intimacy would be to get rid of etiquette and appropriate behavior today. So there is that on the one hand. On the other hand, what is making modern relationships so complicated in a way and so difficult to manage is the fact that they are about validating the self, giving it a sense of worth, which I do not see, or I see as being much less relevant to intimate relationships in the 19th century. So because we are in this relationship together so that you would reconfirm who I am in the world, in fact.
And on an ongoing basis.
On an ongoing basis. Because, and also if you add to this the fact that we are all asked to be very autonomous and self-reliant, it creates a tremendous contradiction and burden on relationships. So the reason why relationships are complicated, it's not because we have impossible fantasies about them, as is often thought, but because modern relationships are the result of a different set of pressures which are properly modern, namely the need for validation and the imperative of autonomy.
Now, this tension between autonomy and validation seems to land asymmetrically, by which I mean women seem to suffer more than men in this regard, that the evidence in your book suggests that. Now, given that all the strides that feminism has made since the 1960s, why is this falling so asymmetrically still?
Well, I'll be very short, because the demonstration is in the book, but it has to do with the fact that the size of the samples from which men and women can choose have changed in modernity. They were similar. Men and women were emotional equals. They were entirely unequal in the social, political, and economic spheres. But when it came to the marriage market, they were equals. Now that marriage markets are so to speak deregulated, in other words, there's no more an agency regulating that, then we see that the different relationship of men and women to marriage, to the family, which is itself dependent on their economic position, and the different sizes of the samples from which they can choose a sexual and romantic partner, the size of these samples are vastly different. Men have many more to choose from than women. This in turn enables an emotional domination which is at the source of many of the difficulties of modern relationships.
Now, one of the ways in which that field has exponentially increased is the internet, where one can go now and assess thousands of potential partners according to all sorts of criteria. Now, I suppose one might think this would make it easier to actually find someone with like aspirations and interests, and, you know, would remove some of the difficulties. But in fact, you point out that it actually brings, again, problems of its own.
Yes, and here I have to go back to the realm of consumer choice. The fact that having more choice does not make it necessarily easier to find someone is clearest in the realm of internet dating sites, where the fact that you can compare between different options dampens your feelings toward one single object. I mean, and that makes sense. When you have very little to choose from, you're more likely to be committed quickly to someone than if you have a technological device that enables you to imagine potentially endless pool of potential partners. And this is what the internet dating site have become, a device to imagine choice. It is both a device that offers choice and enables us to imagine choice. And as such, it makes the capacity to commit to one single person much more difficult.
I find what you wrote late in the book about irony very interesting. And I wondered if you felt that irony had actually become the prevailing mode for modern romantic relationships, because it was a protection against some of these anxieties and uncertainties we've been talking about.
Yes, absolutely. I think that you can hardly say today, I love you, without thinking about the fact that this I love you has been said 1,000 times. I mean, sure, you can say it privately, but if you are someone who is used to put a lot of care in saying what they say in a way that feels authentic, you would be a little bit nervous about saying it, or about writing a love note, or about bringing a romantic present. I mean, you would do it by signaling that you're aware that you are doing a cliché gesture. So it is the fact that we both long for the cliché, or are in the cliché, but need to signal that we are aware of that, that makes the romantic consciousness an ironic one.
Now, you write at the end of the book about wanting to, the way you put it is easing the ache. In other words, you see that there is some potential practical utility to the book beyond being a fascinating intellectual analysis of the terrain. And I wondered in what ways you thought the book might contribute to this easing of the ache.
I think that one of the devastating results of psychological culture, along with the great help it provides people, but one of its devastating results has been to make us think that many of our failures are self-made. And they are self-made because they depend on patterns of thought or patterns of emotions that are the ones that are failing us. The book then hopes to ease, when I say the ache, I mean it hopes to make people realize that many of the emotional and psychological problems they are experiencing are not really theirs. They are also shared by many others, and they are societies, and they are properties of what it means to live in modernity. So that's one element of easing the ache. Then the second element, and that's a corollary to what I just said, is that I think I am a Spinozist, in the sense that I think that when you understand better what it is that is troubling you, understanding it, in fact, enables you to have a better grasp. And I think that psychology has not really understood what some of the difficulties that men and women are facing is about. And it is perhaps because we have not really understood this that we keep aching about it. I think that these ailments, these emotional ailments, then are shared, they are collective, they are institutionally produced and patterned, and that once you realize that you cannot take responsibility for everything that is wrong in your life, that gives you hope. That's what hope is about. It is about being able to devise new strategies after understanding what it is and that you can or cannot improve or change.
You describe how science has essentially demystified love. We think about it as chemical reactions. We're all very wise and worldly about how these things operate. And I wondered if you thought, finally, that some kind of remystification of love is conceivable and desirable.
Oh, nice question. I think it is both conceivable and desirable. I actually love fictions and myth and mystifications. And indeed, I think that what we are living now is through a culture that has deeply demystified love, while at the same time making our longing for it very strong and powerful. We should remystify love, but we should remystify it by changing completely the set of assumptions on which the old mystique, love mystique, was based. Let me just remind you that the old mystique, in which a man kneels in front of a woman and tells her that he worships her, that mystique was based on deep gender inequalities, which were somehow miraculously erased in the love relationship. So if a remystification is to take place, it has to take place by erasing the dimension that power played, in fact, in the old mystique, because this is what it was about. It was about inverting the relationships between men and women in the love relationship. So I am for a remystification, but only after it has gotten rid of what made the old process of mystifying love possible.
Eva Illouz. Why Love Hurts is out now in hardback. You can find full details about it on the Polity website at politybooks.com. I do hope you'll join me again soon for another Polity podcast. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.